The Ananda Brahman is not a long chapter, and we're about halfway finished with it now. The last sentence of the preceding paragraph before we begin tonight tells us where we are. Therefore, we should not hesitate to open ourselves more steadily to whatever experience of the infinite we have, to purify and intensify it, to make it our object of constant thought and contemplation, till it becomes the originating power that acts in us, the Godhead we adore and embrace. Our whole being is put into tune with it, and it is made the very self of our being. Many chapters in the Synthesis of Yoga have spoken to this, to purify, to concentrate, to sharpen, to whet the aspiration, to dwell in consciousness upon the one thing that calls to you from inside, to live in that, never to leave it. That is yoga. His next paragraph continues. Our experience of it has to be purified, and any mental alloy in it, otherwise it departs. We cannot hold it. So there is something else in us, apart from the mind, that will experience this rhapsodic oneness with the divine. The mind has to be quieted. And part of this purification is that it shall cease to be dependent on any cause or exciting condition of mind. It must become its own cause and self-existent, source of all other delight, which will exist only by it, and not attached to any cosmic or other image or symbol through which we first came into contact with it. Our experience of it has to be constantly intensified and made more concentrated. Otherwise, we shall only reflect it in the mirror of the imperfect mind and not reach that point of uplifting and transfiguration by which we are carried beyond the mind into the ineffable bliss. The mind thinks it knows, but it knows by reflection. There's always another object out there. Light hits that object and lands upon its eyes, and it thinks it is illuminated. But what yoga does is to unify the being. The substance of the one you seek becomes your own substance. Note again, intensified, made more concentrated. Even though this is the yoga of love, it still demands tapasya. It still demands forceful effort. One has to exclude the things that distract and annoy and block and land in the lap of she or he whom you love. Object of our constant thought and contemplation. It will turn all that is into itself, reveal itself as the universal Ananda Brahman, and make all existence its outpouring. So from that concentrated experience inside, one then comes out and embraces again the world. The world is not the enemy. It seems to be a distraction, but is it is a figuring of the divine, but one must be housed in the presence of the divine first to fully appreciate it. If we wait upon it for the inspiration of all our inner and our outer acts, it will become the joy of the divine pouring itself through us in light and love and power on life and all that lives. This farther felicity Sri Aurobindo intended his integral yoga to do, to achieve, to reveal, because beginning with himself and the mother at the core of the ashram, he wanted to illuminate and felicitate all those around him and make them beacons of light that would appear elsewhere throughout the length and the breadth of India, traveling to other places on the globe, that this integral yoga could begin to work as a force of unification. But unification means yoga, so it meant leading societies by dynamic positive examples. Yogis, yoginis, who have fixed themselves in that consciousness and are ever present and ever active in a society that becomes better and better. This was his idea. He vouchsafed it in a few letters here and there, but that is, in a sense, our posterity. Now we're charged with that mission. Sought by the adoration and love of the soul, it reveals itself as the Godhead. We see in it the face of God and know the bliss of our lover. Tuning our whole being to it, we grow into a happy perfection of likeness to it, a human rendering of the divine nature. And when it becomes in every way the self of our self, we are fulfilled in being and we bear the plenitude. So he's writing this in 1918, years before he was able to found an ashram around him, or have one founded around him. Working solitarily, remember, his divinely appointed partner, whom we call the mother, was in Japan, thousands of miles away. And he working assiduously and mostly alone in Pondicherry. Brahman always reveals himself to us in three ways: within ourselves, above our plane, around us in the universe. We're familiar with this dominant theme that emerges again and again in the Life Divine and was an opening chord in the synthesis of yoga as well. Within us, there are two centers of the Purusha, the inner soul through which he touches us to our awakening. There's the Purusha in the lotus of the heart, which opens upward all our powers, and the Purusha in the thousand-petaled lotus, whence descend through the thought and will, opening the third eye in us, the lightnings of vision and the fire of the divine energy. So the one leads you to the disclosure of the psychic presence inside, the secret soul unknown to most, and above, of course, the higher self, who descends with peace, light, and with dynamic verities which shatter the mere mortal. One has to be prepared for them. The bliss existence may come to us through either one of these centers. When the lotus of the heart breaks open, we feel a divine joy, love, and peace expanding in us like a flower of light which irradiates the whole being. So again, when it breaks open, this is a sudden disclosure. There can be effort, 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 constant tapasya. But that auspicious moment, that hour of God, Brahma Muhurta, is unknown to the seeker. But when it comes, it seems as if a sudden reversal of consciousness, something cataclysmic, which destroys all the prevailing darkness and ignorance around. And suddenly, leaping out from the inner recesses, is this bright fire. They can then unite themselves with their secret source, the divine in our hearts, and adore him as in a temple. They can flow upwards to take possession of the thought and the will and break out upward towards the transcendent. They stream out in thought and feeling and act towards all that is around us. And he's speaking here about all the powers of our natural being, which now are drawn towards things divine, no longer interested in the playthings of the common world. But so long as our normal being offers any obstacle or is not wholly molded into a response to this divine influence or an instrument of this divine possession, the experience will be intermittent and we may fall back constantly into our old mortal heart. But by repetition, abhyasa, or by the force of our desire and adoration of the divine, it will be progressively remolded until this abnormal experience becomes our natural consciousness. So abhyasa, repetition, or constant practice. So an alternation, an uneven experience at first, which becomes steadier and then becomes fixed. An abnormal experience, something which is unusual, that stands out, then becomes your native ground, that upon which you stand. Two, this idea of response only to the divine influence. That is what is purity. That is what is sincerity. And we have to tune the whole nature to do that, so there's nothing discordant in the seeking, in the quest, that all the members of the being are equally invested in the demands of the sadhana, of the tapasya. When the other upper lotus opens, the whole mind becomes full of a divine light, joy, and power, behind which is the divine, the Lord of our being on his throne, with our soul beside him, or drawn inward into his rays. All the thought and will become then a luminosity, power, and ecstasy. In communication with the transcendent, this can pour down towards our mortal members and flow by them outwards on the world. So with the first lotus, the inner lotus opening, we're bringing all the powers inward, then upwards, and they begin to ascend. Here, the opening is from above below. This idea of the soul sitting with the divine goes all the way back to the Rig Veda with Kutsa, Indra. And often we see the same imagery in Puranic sources. But when we are housed beyond the lid of the mind and can live in that wide light above, we can draw down those energies, those powers of universal nature into our own being, and then we become a center individual but universalized, which then radiates those same out into the world. So it might be peace, it might be light, it might be an enormous Shakti. In this dawn, too, there are, as the Vedic mystics knew, our alternations of its day and night, our exiles from the light. Of course, we see this in the chapter in the Secret of the Veda on the hymns to the Atris. But as we grow in the power to hold this new existence, we become able to look long on the sun from which this irradiation proceeds, and in our inner being we can grow one body with it. This reminds us too of the idea in the Rig Veda about the eternal succession of the dawns. There is dawn followed by darkness, and yet another dawn comes, until finally in this eternal succession there is the permanent dawn, and there is no more darkness. That, of course, is the fullness of realization. But each time we experience a dawn, it takes us closer to the fixing of that permanent light in our being. Rig Veda, first mandala, hymn 113 and verse 8, if you want to look at it. Sometimes the rapidity of this change depends on the strength of our longing for the divine thus revealed and on the intensity of our force of seeking. But at others, it proceeds rather by a passive surrender to the rhythms of his all-wise working, which acts always by its own at first inscrutable method. So the variations in the terms of the yoga dependent on the nature of the adhikara, of the person, the equipment that one is bringing along, whether it can manifest the sincerity to fix that realization at once so that it doesn't depart, or whether it has to come again and again. And then, of course, the will of the yoga shakti determines. But the latter becomes the foundation when our love and trust are complete and our whole being lies in the clasp of a power that is perfect love and wisdom. Our whole being, that means all of us, mind, life, and body, that's integration. The whole being is integrated. And here, too, we see love and wisdom lying in the arms of an opened power. So again, integration. The divine reveals himself in the world around us. When we look upon that with a spiritual desire of delight that seeks him in all things, there is often a sudden opening by which the veil of forms is itself turned into a revelation, a universal spiritual presence, a universal peace, a universal infinite delight has manifested, imminent, embracing, all penetrating. This presence, by our love of it, our delight in it, our constant thought of it returns and grows upon us. It becomes the thing that we see, and all else is only its habitation, form, and symbol. Even all that is most outward, the body, the form, the sound, whatever our senses sees, are seen as this presence. They cease to be physical and are changed into a substance of spirit. This transformation means a transformation of our own inner consciousness. We are taken by the surrounding presence into itself, and we become part of it. Our own mind, life, body become to us only its habitation and temple, a form of its working and an instrument of its self-expression. All is only soul and body of this delight. Now, these last two sentences, read in context of what would occur a few years later, in the late fall of 1926, with the descent of the Overmind into his body, this is translated on the 24th of November into his physical experience. This is the divine seen all around us. Pardon me. This is the divine seen around us and on our own physical plane, but he may reveal himself above. We see or feel him as a high uplifted presence, a great infinite of Ananda above us, or in it, our Father in heaven, and do not feel or see him in ourselves or around us. So this is the experience of the Anandamaya, of experiencing delight above the worldly plane as a transcendence. Remember, Sri Aurobindo noted about Krishna that he represented the Anandamaya at the overmental level, that body of bliss who came intentionally to earth to manifest that as a rung in the evolving ladder. So long as we keep this vision, the mortality in us is quelled by that immortality. It feels the light, power, and joy and responds to it according to its capacity. Or it feels the descent of the spirit. And it is then for a time transformed or else uplifted into some luster of reflection of the light and power. It becomes a vessel of the Ananda. But at other times, it lapses into the old mortality and exists or works dully or pettily in the ruck of its earthly habits. A wonderful word, it means a wrinkle, a fold, a crease. So you get tucked into something which is holding you back. It's not clean and open and exposed. Instead, it's tucked away. So this, again, this alternation of day and night, this return to a former way of being, the complete redemption comes by the descent of the divine power into the human mind and body and the remolding of their inner life into the divine image, what the Vedic seers called the birth of the sun by the sacrifice. Well, this is image two in the tantras. And in either case, it's the imposition of the Godhead into the human body through and the various chakras in the tantras, but then finally fixing it in the human frame. It is, in fact, by a continual sacrifice or offering, a sacrifice of adoration and aspiration, of works, of thought and knowledge, of the mounting flame of the Godward will, that we build ourselves into the being of this infinite. So here again, an image of the flame and its fuel. The fuel is our thoughts, our energisms, our intentional acts of offering. That is absolutely Vedic. When we possess firmly this consciousness of the Ananda Brahman in all of these three manifestations, above, within, around, we have the full oneness of it and embrace all existences in its delight, peace, joy, and love. Then all the worlds become the body of this self. So again, the realization has to be multiplied. We can't sit satisfied with achieving the discovery of the psychic inside or sitting broadly in the universality of the cosmic self, or simply rising out of all individuality and cosmicity into the sublime above and some lost transcendent to the world. We have to have all three. And again, this is what occurred in Sri Aurobindo on the 24th. It's almost as if it's a line written that would be revealed in his own life, prophetic, perhaps unintentional, but just so. But we have not the richest knowledge of this Ananda. If it is only an impersonal presence, largeness, or immanence that we feel, if our adoration has not been intimate enough for this being to reveal to us, out of its wide-extended joy, the face and body, and make us feel the hands of the friend and lover, its impersonality is the blissful greatness of the Brahman. But from that can look out upon us the sweetness and intimate control of the Divine Personality. For Ananda is the presence of the Self and master of our being, and the stream of its outflowing can be the pure joy of his Leela. So look at this, has not been intimate enough. So what is prime is experience, to enter into communion and enter into felt oneness with the Supreme. It is the secret of oneness that we find in love, in knowledge, and in works. It is the secret that Krishna, as Purushottama in the Gita, reveals to Arjuna. That mysterious being, beyond all scale, beyond all determination, is a friend, is a lover, and establishes itself as an impersonal infinity from which it manifests a mutable world, but populates both mutability, immutability, and whatever it is beyond that we can't describe. So we take up next week then the last chapter in the Yoga of Divine Love. But let's conclude tonight with something from Savitri. And this is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. And we'll begin on page 58. Yet a spiritual secret aid is there. While the tardy evolution's coils wind on, and nature hews her way through adamant, a divine intervention thrones above. Alive in a dead rotating universe, we whirl not here upon a casual globe, abandoned to a task beyond our force. even through the tangled anarchy called fate, and through the bitterness of death and fall, an outstretched hand is felt upon our lives. It is near us in unnumbered bodies and births. In its unslackening grasp, it keeps for us safe the one inevitable supreme result no will can take away and no doom change, the crown of conscious immortality, the Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. One who has shaped this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitudes of our lives. He works through the hard breath of battle and toil. He works through our sins and sorrows and our tears. His knowledge overrules our nescience. Whatever the appearance we must bear, whatever our strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can see but drift and bail, a mighty guidance leads us still through all. After we have served this great divided world, God's bliss and oneness are our inborn right. A date is fixed in the calendar of the unknown, an anniversary of the birth sublime. Our soul shall justify its checkered walk. All will come near that now is not or far. These calm and distant mites shall act at last. Immovably ready for their destined task, the ever-wise, compassionate brilliances await the sound of the incarnate's voice to leap and bridge the chasms of ignorance and heal the hollow yearning gulfs of life and fill the abyss that is the universe. Here, meanwhile, at the spirit's opposite pole, in the mystery of the deeps that God has built for his abode below the thinker's sight, in this compromise of a stark absolute truth with the light that dwells near the dark end of things, in this tragicomedy of divine disguise, this long, far-seeking for joy ever near, in the grandiose dream of which the world is made, in this gold dome on a black dragon base, the conscious force that acts in nature's breast, a dark-robed laborer in the cosmic scheme carrying clay images of the unborn gods, executrix of the inevitable idea, hampered, enveloped by the hoops of fate, patient trustee of slow eternal time, absolves from hour to hour her secret charge. All she foresees in masked imperative depths. The dumb intention of the unconscious gulfs answers to a will that sees upon the heights, and the evolving word's first syllable, ponderous, brute-sensed, contains its luminous close. Privy to a summit victory's vast descent, and the portent of the soul's immense uprise. Namaste, Jai Ma.